This is Fresh Air. There's a growing body of African-American writing that describes the experience of growing up black and middle class in America. My guest Jake Lamar is one of the younger writers to complete a book on the subject. His new memoir is called Bourgeois Blues. He left his job at Time magazine to write the book. Here's a passage from the opening chapter.
For me, the lines between the black and white worlds had always been blurred. Growing up, I took my race for granted. I was born in 1961 during the heyday of the civil rights movement. At school, I was taught African American history and read African American literature. At home, I was bred to believe that I was at least the equal of any other person, black or white. I enjoyed advantages that most blacks of my father's generation and many of my own could only have dreamed of. A middle-class upbringing, a private school education, a Harvard degree, a job writing on national affairs at Time magazine. I tried to live my life by Dr. King's credo, judging people not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And I simply assumed that all reasonable human beings did the same. But the older I got, the more I found that the color of my skin was the dominant factor in how people judged me, and judgments were getting harsher all the time. Black and white people alike had certain notions about every aspect of my life, how I should dress and talk, how I was supposed to choose my friends and lovers, where I should live, how and what I should write. There were black people who saw American life as a perpetual race war and expected me to choose sides. There were white people who presumed that what I wanted was to be just like them and who were dismayed to learn otherwise. "You know what your problem is, Jake," a black friend once said. "You're too white for black people and too black for white people." I began to wonder, was I some sort of freak?
You write that your parents' attitudes towards race often confused you. On the one hand, you were prohibited as a child from watching The Little Rascals because the images were so racist. But on the other hand, your parents would say things about ignorant niggers and loud, nappy-haired women, and you could never quite figure this out.
Yeah, it's a curious contradiction, I think, for people who were coming up at that time. The negative images that were imposed on them in their youth, they tried to fight against them as they grew older, but I think there was still some residue of that sort of discomfort and prejudice against their own people.
You wrote something interesting about your experiences in private school, and that is that you found that in some circles, being black was almost an advantage because for a lot of the white students, you know, black was really hip, so it was really cool to have black friends.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, you were just instantly considered cool, you know, just by virtue of being black.
What were the advantages and disadvantages of that for you?
Well, I think to a certain extent, it was assumed that I may have had a street smartness that I never had. You know, I was always, especially in the first 12 or 13 years of my life, a pretty nerdy kid. I didn't consider myself hip at all. But that white kids did consider me, you know, somehow, or expected of me a street smartness that I didn't have. It was just one of the first times that I ran into this sort of strange conflict between what others perceive you to be and what you really are. In a way, it was fine. I didn't mind, you know, to a certain extent, I didn't mind the coolness that was expected from me, yet I couldn't really always deliver either, so.
You moved to Riverdale, a very prosperous area in the New York area, and you write that there, for the first time, you realized you were starting to terrify ordinary pedestrians. What was the kind of response that you're referring to there?
Well, it was just this bizarre thing, every black male I know has experienced this at one time or another in a city. I write in the book about walking down the street on a sunny morning, my book bag slung over my shoulder, and I would see a somewhat elderly white pedestrian ahead of me. As they sensed my presence, they would turn, and soon as they got a look at me, a terror would flash in their eyes. They would stop dead in their tracks and stare wide-eyed at me as I passed, you know, virtually paralyzed with fear. This was the strangest thing, one of the strangest things I'd ever experienced at that point, but it became a more and more common thing and something that happens to this day. You know, the reaction is not always as extreme, but you might stop to ask a person directions on the street and then they're sort of recoiling. I think there is this fear of young black men.
What did that bring out in you?
Mainly, it at first, just dismay, eventually a sort of anger, and now it's one of those petty annoyances that you try to have roll off your back. But I talk about a friend of mine who I grew up with, my best friend, who is a very tall person, a child of an interracial marriage, and he would really terrify the people. And he said, you know, that when we were 16, he said, it makes me want to mug them. I mean, if that's what they think I'm going to do. I mean, he's one of the most gentle people I've ever met. He would never do harm to another person. Yet it provoked this anger in him that they would have this expectation that they would not, you know, bother to see him as an individual, but as some sort of terrifying stereotype.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jake Lamar, and he's written a memoir called Bourgeois Blues, an American Memoir. And he's a former reporter for Time magazine. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jake Lamar, author of the new memoir, Bourgeois Blues. You went to Harvard, and in your book, you describe Harvard as a dull, cold, segregated place. Mm-hmm. How so?
I didn't ever really have a sense at Harvard that I never had the sense of community that I had expected there. And I found that at Harvard, people just sort of function in their own little pockets. This was true to a certain extent at high school, but my high school was so small, and I think there was a sort of an effort was made to have more mingling across different groups. At Harvard, people really kept to their own cliques, and those cliques were defined by different things, you know, by ethnicity or by social standing or by extracurricular interests. But I found that it was a place where people really stayed in their pockets, and it was not a warm place at all.
Did you feel that a lot of white people were always asking themselves, well, is he here because of affirmative action? Will he ever really measure up?
It wasn't a sense that I got personally a lot, though it did happen. I had one teacher in English class in particular who just... you know, it's funny, this sort of what I call a crypto racism. You know, people aren't openly insulting to you. Nobody is ever, you know, called me a nigger or burned a cross on my doorstep. But there is this condescension and this way in which people will patronize you. And anyone, you know, with an ounce of awareness knows when they're being patronized. But when a black person feels that a white person is condescending to them, it's often dismissed as oversensitivity or some sort of paranoia. Yet it's such a strong and obvious feeling that you have. And I did get that from one teacher at Harvard in particular.
How did you deal with it?
I actually talked to him about it. I wanted to know if there was some weirdness between him and me, because he didn't seem to take seriously a lot of the things I was saying, and I'd always been a pretty successful student. The reaction was one of total surprise on his part, and he said, well, no, there wouldn't be anything at all. I don't think I've done that at all. And after that point, he seemed to sort of go in the other direction, went out of his way to be nice and attentive, you know. And in the whole dozy do, it's just sort of irritating that someone just can't be normal, you know.
With Time magazine, you wrote a piece that you had intended to title Native Sons, and it was about inner-city black men. You weren't happy with the way the piece was edited.
Mm-hmm.
What was the difference between how you conceived of the piece and how it finally came out?
Well, the one thing, the main thing that disturbed me was the intro about an individual we wrote about in the story, and I attempted to convey all the vicissitudes of his life and to get that to illustrate the broader points of the piece. It was cut down so that only the bare facts of his life came across, that he was 23 years old and was serving a life sentence for taking part in a robbery that resulted in the death of the owner. It was not said in this edited version that he wasn't accused of pulling the trigger but was sentenced to life imprisonment anyway, or that he was attempting to do something with his life at that point. I felt that a complicated story about an individual in extenuating circumstances was boiled down to a sort of punchy scary caption. And I think that that's usually the way black males in the inner city are presented.
When your story was published, the pub letter, that thing near the table of contents, that's a behind-the-scenes look at one of the
letter from the publisher. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's behind-the-scenes story of one of the stories in the magazine that week. And so you were quoted in that letter, since the letter was about your story, you were quoted as saying that you were reminded that you were fortunate to grow up in a two-parent home and that you had access to good education. When you read that quote back, when the magazine came out, you were really horrified. What bothered you about what you had said?
Well, it's the whole, you know, it's this sort of constant ambivalence. You know, there was nothing untrue about what I said. I was, did feel grateful to have grown up in relatively privileged circumstances. Yet I felt that, you know, with my clean-cut visage in the pub letter, I felt as if I was being set up as some sort of contrast with the native sons, the sort of poor and, you know, more threatening black males whose pictures appeared later in the magazine and who were shot against brick walls and barbed wire. And I felt that I was being sort of set up as a quote non-threatening unquote alternative, and it made me really uncomfortable. And I think this is the ambivalence a middle class black person feels a lot of the time. You know, that we're sort of being held up as examples of nice blacks while being contrasted in a really unflattering way with the less privileged.
Let me bring up a kind of complicated issue. The way you describe your father, there was a period of his life when it seemed like your father was kind of particularly tempted by white women, as if white women were a kind of special, like, gourmet dish or something. And you've been involved in relationships with white women over the years and wanted to make sure no one would, you know, perceive it as that kind of thing. And I wonder what kind of difficulties that whole thing created for you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like your mother, for instance, you were afraid that your mother would see your relationships with white women because of the way she perceived of your father's interest in white women.
Yeah, I think my father, when I was growing up, as I say in the book, used to sort of taunt my mother by leering at white women on TV or on the street. I don't know if I would say that he was tempted by a lot of white women, but he did have one long-standing affair with a white woman. And as I say in the book, there was a rapport between them. There was a genuine affection between them, or at least coming from my father, that I never sensed with my mother. The woman he was involved with was very tough and aggressive, like my father. And I think on some level, they just related as people in a way that my mother and father never did. But I also sensed in my father's relationship with his mistress that her being white was a sort of a bonus, and that for him it sort of signified a way in which he had arrived, in a way that he had risen above his humble, segregated beginnings. For me, it was always different having grown up around white people, and I just, you know, I think related to people on a more individual basis, and didn't, you know, I write about being a kid and having a crush on two different girls in my parochial school, one black, one white, and it really never made a difference to me.
Even though it wasn't an issue for you having an interracial relationship, did you feel it was an issue for the people around you, you know, in ways that would make you self-conscious, even though you weren't self-conscious within the relationship itself?
Well, this is the thing, you know. I mean, I always liked to think that I wasn't self-conscious in the relationship itself. And I write in the book about a woman I was involved with for 3 years. And, you know, we sort of contemplated marriage. You know, and it was never anything that we were, you know, about to do. But I always sort of shied away from the issue. And a year and a half after we'd broken up, she said to me that she thought that my breaking up with her was a failure of nerve. And I thought she meant, well, you know, the nerve to get married, because, you know, I, you know, wasn't ready to make a commitment like that. But she emphasized that it was that she thought I didn't have the nerve to marry a white woman. And I had never really thought about that and didn't think that there was that sort of reluctance on my part, thought that that race would not have been that big an issue for me. But I had to wonder if it really was. And I think there was this sort of sense that if I were to marry a white woman, that would be some sort of betrayal or something that I really wasn't ready to do. And I think that that sort of racial stigma might have been deeper in my consciousness than I ever realized.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jake LaMarre's new memoir is Bourgeois Blues. This is Fresh Air.